When we begin to discuss the subject of ritual and belief, there is no clear place to start. We don't find ourselves, as with some subjects, in a position where we can build up from the very basic to the increasingly complicated. Wherever you approach systems of ritual and belief, you have to start somewhere. You have to come in from the outside. And therefore, it is quite sensible to begin in a place which some people would find very surprising, and this particular topic is witchcraft. Witchcraft is not, in some ways, the most obvious place to start such a study, because many people would feel that what we ought to do to start off with is to play out the complete drama of people's encounters with the other side, with the superhuman. But in order to keep this simple from the beginning, I'll put that topic off until after we've had a look at witchcraft, because there are certain very elementary features about human fear of witchcraft which makes it convenient to start here. And in the course of what I'm going to say today, I'm hoping that this feature of witchcraft will become quite clear. Witchcraft presents us with an immediate problem. What is it? Now, in modern... When we come to discuss the whole very large topic of systems of ritual and belief, the difficulty that presents itself to us immediately is that there is no clear starting point. We can start to approach the subject from a whole series of different directions, and it's not possible to build a knowledge of the subject off from very first principles and then through to very complex later endpoints. One could, as a matter of taste, begin anywhere. But there are some places which would be very complicated as a beginning. For example, if we were to begin with the Russian Orthodox Church, this would land us in at the deep end. We would need not only to talk about the history of the Russian Orthodox Church, and indeed of the Russias, but we would have to talk about the relations between priesthoods and governments. We would have to talk about doctrine. We would have to root the Russian Orthodox Church back into the history of the Christian Church and the great schism of the Jews in what we now call the first century AD, and a whole host of other complications. By contrast with this kind of very complex beginning, we could begin, and this is much to be recommended in some ways, with the total way of life of a particular very small society, perhaps a group of bushmen in the Kalahari or a village in a clearing in the Amazon rainforest. But by far the most elementary starting point in the study of ritual and belief is the topic of witchcraft, and as I will hope to explain later in this lecture, that is a straightforward topic, or rather a relatively straightforward topic, because it is based upon some of the most fundamental premises in human assumptions. In many ways, witchcraft is a very bad place to start a study of this kind, because as far as we know, the vast majority of human beings are not witches, the vast majority of human beings do not practice witchcraft, and witchcraft is an evil, a criminal activity. It may seem very strange to start the study of ordinary, normal human life with practices which are perverted and aberrant. but in other ways, as I shall make increasingly clear, I hope, as we go on today, there are very good reasons why we should study witchcraft at the beginning and not later on. To start with, then, what is witchcraft? When we look at witchcraft from the point of view of a big urban conurbation at the very end of the 20th century, what we see is a certain amount of confusion within the English language. If you asked many young people in Basildon or in Surbiton what witchcraft meant to them, you would find that for many of them, witchcraft means virtually anything that is at all spooky, anything that is to do with the occult, anything to do with the supernatural. This is a complication which I ought to deal with in the next lecture, when I turn my attention much more to the place of witchcraft in the modern period in Europe. But in broad terms, such a view is so broad that it means that witchcraft for these young people virtually has no technical meaning whatever. It is not a technical term. It's a vague sort of poetic term, an emotive term. It denotes an ambiance. It doesn't actually tell us about a particular body of human practices or bodies of knowledge. Now, in order to deal with witchcraft as a precise and technical subject, I shall have to use a definition which is on the one hand fairly brief, but is also very restrictive. And the definition that I shall be using throughout this series is this. Witchcraft is the harming of members of one's own community by means of superhuman power. Witchcraft is the harming of members of one's own community by superhuman power. Now, that definition in practice has already been widely used over the last 100 years by anthropologists, though there is a complication here affecting differences between witchcraft and sorcery, which I will have to come on to later. But something along these lines is to be found in a great many ethnographic accounts which have been produced of non-European peoples by European anthropologists or European anthropologists in terms of their culture. I mean, for cultural purposes, Americans and Canadians are Europeans. Now, the definition that I am using is one which will perhaps become clearer as we go on, but each feature of that definition is critical. Witchcraft involves the causing of harm. I have been reprimanded in recent years by a student who herself practices magic because she says that witchcraft is not necessarily causing harm. She's using a more modern sort of Basildon type definition of witchcraft. But if you go back to the time of our Angle and Saxon ancestors, it is quite clear that they regarded this category, witchcraft, as an evil practice, a practice which was evil long before the Angles and the Saxons became Christians. They didn't discover that witchcraft was evil because the Christian missionaries told them so. They knew jolly well that it was evil, doubtless long before they set off across the North Sea to colonise the British Isles. Witchcraft, then, is a term deeply rooted in the texture of the Teutonic languages. It has an ancient meaning, and that ancient meaning is not very far from the working anthropological meaning which I've already given you. Witchcraft is criminal. It is a practice which is secretive. People who do it either keep entirely quiet about doing it, or they hint to their neighbours that they may have this power without enabling those neighbours to actually pin anything on them in a court of law, because to do so would expose them to very real danger of legal redress, even indeed execution. At the same time, I emphasise the fact that witchcraft is an offence committed against members of one's own community. People may use these powers against other people in other communities and will not be reprimanded. Furthermore, they will be able to do this quite openly. A good example of this comes from the Amazon basin in South America. Large numbers of practicing shamans in the Amazon basin are alleged to have the ability to move thunderstorms around. They are credited with the ability to actually ensure which settlement in the forest the thunderstorms are at their maximum over. Now, no one in these South American villages is very disturbed by the shamans doing this kind of thing, so long as they make jolly sure that those thunderstorms are over enemy villages. Any practitioner who was moving thunderstorms about in such a way that they affected his own village would be regarded as wicked and indeed effectively as some kind of witch. So it isn't what you can do that makes you a witch, it's the way you do it. It's the way in which you actually focus your power upon either enemy peoples or your own people. If you practice in such a way that you harm your own people, you are a witch. And the third ingredient in the definition, which is critical, is that witchcraft is not a crime of the everyday mundane world. It is not like burning somebody's house down or raping his daughter. These are offences which are familiar offences, recognised as offences in all known human societies, but they do not involve the use of superhuman power. Witchcraft is a particular kind of offence because you can commit this offence only with extra aid. You have to tap in to the great outside out there in order to commit it, which means, of course, there are going to be large numbers of people who can't do it, and even in societies where there are large numbers of people who can do it, it doesn't follow that everybody will be able to do it or that everybody will have as much power as certain other people who will be more powerful practitioners of this kind. That may seem a very long-winded introduction, but what I'm saying is necessary because it is important to avoid a wishy-washy starting point when we deal with witchcraft. There are a number of other observations of a general kind which are worth making about witchcraft, but I won't say too much about the general features at the beginning, though I will have to work my way through them as we go towards the end of this lecture today. Just a few observations about witchcraft as a human phenomenon. Witchcraft, in some ways, is an excellent way to start a discussion of human behaviour, because as far as we know, in all parts of the world, everybody knows what witchcraft is. Witchcraft is a part of human life. Witchcraft, as I've defined it early in this lecture, is a part of human life. And everywhere in the world, people have at least one word for it. There's a complication here. In some societies, there's more than one kind of witchcraft. People may have several words meaning witchcraft. But the point is, everybody apparently has at least one. And in all parts of the world, wherever you go, you can assume that however reticent the people with whom you are living are about talking about witchcraft, they all know about it. Now, there's another curious feature about witchcraft, which is this, that although apparently witchcraft is part of universal human knowledge, it is found everywhere, it is quite clear that there are some very striking differences between the actual fear of witchcraft. In many human societies at a particular time, you will find that witchcraft is not of any great importance because very few people, or indeed possibly nobody at all, is actually afraid of it. And the reason for this is they're quite convinced that nobody is doing it where they are. In other words, you'll go to some parts of the world and you'll find that people say, oh yes, witchcraft is very serious, but there isn't any of it round here. And not surprisingly, in those places, people are not going to get very excited about witchcraft, they're not going to accuse their neighbours of witchcraft, and they're not going to take elaborate steps to combat witchcraft. On the other hand, when you go to other parts of the world, you discover that the people are absolutely obsessed with witchcraft, that they talk about witchcraft, they are constantly looking over their shoulder in a metaphysical sense to see if people are bewitching them. There are a whole flurry of accusations, there are trials, and of course, in certain circumstances, and I shall say a bit more about this next time in the second lecture, in certain circumstances, the fear of witchcraft reaches a frenzy of a type which we often describe as a witch hunt, and I'll say a bit more about that later, as I say. But this extraordinary difference in time and space is something which is very notable about it. Dealing, as we are, with something which is universal in human general knowledge, it is remarkable that sometimes neighbouring societies have quite different views of witchcraft in terms of its danger and its intensity. And it's remarkable too, and again I'll have to emphasise this a bit more in the next lecture, remarkable too that in a particular society which has for hundreds of years ticked over with a rather low-key attitude towards witchcraft, there are occasions when the fear of witchcraft surges up to hysterical intensity, as happened, for example, in England and Scotland in about the reign of King James I, that is, King James VI. What we do need to realise is that we're dealing here with something which is on the one hand very basic in human knowledge, but at the same time is clearly not a constant. We are not dealing here with something which simply goes on being the same year after year, generation after generation, because people's attitudes towards it are, in certain contexts, constantly shifting. I can give you an example from my own experience here, because during a great deal of the 1960s, I was living in a part of East Africa, which is, in administrative terms, in the north centre of Tanzania. And here, in fairly close contact, are a number of different ethnic groups speaking widely different languages, but sharing to a considerable extent the same culture. One of these peoples, the people with whom I was particularly concerned and about among whom I spent a good deal of my time, the Rangi, in the 1960s had a very considerable general knowledge of witchcraft. Many of them could discuss witchcraft at great length, not the kind of subject that it's good to broach early after your arrival in a place, but once you've settled in and you've been there for a bit, you can perhaps get some of the people talking about witchcraft, and indeed the Rangi of the 60s were full of the most interesting general knowledge about witchcraft. But the moment you ask them, well, can you give me an example of somebody being accused or convicted of witchcraft? No, they couldn't. Apparently witchcraft was something which was simply part of general knowledge. Now, within walking distance to the north of them, at the south end of Lake Manyara, live another people, the Mbowe, who speak exactly the same language as the Rangi. They speak a different dialect of it, but anyone who can speak Rangi has no great difficulty speaking to the Mbowe. And among the Mbowe in the 1960s, the situation was totally different. Among them, accusations of witchcraft were very frequent and indeed were expected and were taken for granted. To such an extent were the Mbowe preoccupied with witchcraft that their neighbours up in the hills in the same area, people called the Irak, regarded the Mbowe as an absolutely witch-ridden people. They saw them as a people totally preoccupied with witchcraft, quite different from themselves, and indeed, as I've already indicated, quite different from the Rangi. Now, this is an extraordinary example, because the Rangi and the Mbowe are in some ways are more or less the same people. The differences between them are tiny. The Rangi and the Mbowe both claim that they are the descendants of two ancestresses who were themselves closely related, that these two ancestresses were sisters, and that therefore, in a sense, the Mbowe and the Rangi are sibling people. It is very probable, indeed, they have a shared historical origin if one goes back far enough. But what is remarkable is that whereas in so many respects they are culturally almost identical, their attitudes towards witchcraft in the 60s, when I was there, were clearly dramatically opposed. And this kind of contrast is found in many parts of the world. I'm not going to try and cope with this problem. Clearly it is a huge problem in the understanding of human beings. But I want to talk about witchcraft in more general terms. And what I'm going to do is to look in a very brief outline at one of the classic instances of witchcraft accusation which has been published. And this is Evans Pritchard's account of witchcraft accusations among the Zande people, as the Zande were in the 1920s. One has to remember, of course, when dealing with human groups, that none of them live in a timeless now. History is moving on all the time. The Zande of the 1920s, in a very real sense, no longer exist. If you go to the part of Zande country where Evans Pritchard lived, that is, on what was then the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan side of the border, you will find that the Zande now are treating Evans Pritchard's account of that period as part of their history. It's something which happened in their own past, but they themselves find the conditions he describes rather unfamiliar. I shall concentrate my attention briefly on what was happening in the 1920s. At that time, as indeed still today, Zande country not only straddled the international boundaries of the Nile-Congo watershed, but was divided, and indeed was divided when the Europeans arrived in the area, into a number of small kingdoms whose royal families were all related to each other because they belonged to a single clan, the Avangara. Now, the basic practice of witchcraft accusation, I'm not now talking about the way in which the Zande practiced witchcraft, I shall say a bit more about that issue in a moment, but the basic practice of witchcraft accusation among the Zande of Evans Pritchard's group of kingdoms was that the prevalence of accusation was in fact quite high. It was again rather more like the Mbowe than like the Rangi. And what happened was that when somebody suffered some sort of harm, which they felt might have a cause which could be detected, they went to a diviner to check why this had happened. Evans Pritchard gave some now notorious examples among Africanists of the sorts of things that happened. You walk along a path and you stub your toe on a concealed root. Later, your toe festers. This is clearly a very suspicious circumstance. After all, why should it fester? You don't always have a festering toe when you stub it on a concealed branch, so there must be some special reason why it has festered. Similarly, sometimes people sitting under granaries, which are raised up on stilts in the heat of the day, are killed or injured when one of these granaries collapses. The reason why it collapses is because termites have eaten away the roots, away at the base of the stilts on which the granary is raised up, and as a result, after a bit, the weight of the granary brings it down. Again, however, of course, the Zande were well aware that these things weren't collapsing every day, and they asked questions about why is it when those particular people were sitting under it on that particular day that it collapsed, and this rouses the suspicion, among some at least, that there may have been a case of witchcraft in this instance. The way in which the diviners proceed is described by Evans Pritchard. Diviners had available to them a number of oracular means which enabled them to proceed with their divinatory methods. The only one of these which the Zande themselves actually trusted was the so-called poison oracle, which was based upon a series of what one might call controlled experiments. That the process by which it was done is something which you can read for yourselves in Evans Pritchard's account and in some detail. But fundamentally, what the diviners did was to prepare a poison with the aid of a number of plants which were growing in the area, which were known to the diviners, and this produced a concoction which was known in Zande as Benge. This concoction was well known to be a variable medication. It didn't always have the same strength, and before they used it, the diviners always carefully tested it upon chickens to see that either it didn't kill all of them or it killed none of them. You had to have Benge of a strength which would kill some chickens but not all. And this process was therefore in the nature of an experimentation. I mean, the diviners were well aware of broadly statistics. They were well aware of what we would nowadays in Europe call experimental method. And they therefore were not behaving with any kind of blind or stupid faith in a method. Zande did not trust absolutely any of the methods with which they were involved. The only one that had any claim to being reliable was the poison oracle, the Benge method, and this method itself had to be very carefully controlled. Once they had a good supply of reliable Benge, the diviners had to use it immediately because they knew perfectly well that, like other medication, this one spoiled with time. You had to use fresh Benge. And therefore, of course, if you wanted to find the answer to the question, is this person being bewitched, you had to apply the Benge to a chicken when that Benge was fresh. What happened to the chicken gave you the answer to your question, but of course, with their characteristic interest in statistics and experimental method, the diviners were not going to ask the question just once. They were going to ask it again and again. They were going to get a whole run of answers before they relied upon them. There came a point in this process where it became clear that somebody had been bewitched, and this person was then confronted with their crime. If they claimed that they had not committed it, and one of the interesting features about one aspect of Zande witchcraft was that it was possible to be a witch without knowing it, and therefore it was possible to suddenly be confronted and to realise, oh my God, I'm a witch. If the witch confessed and duly blew some cooling water on the wing of the accusing dead fowl, then they would be absolved from all crime, and so long as they never turned to witchcraft again, for practical purposes, they were regarded as guiltless. But if they persisted in their claim that they had not done any harm to one of their neighbours, then the whole case could be taken from the diviner to the local king's court, and happily for the Zande, the poison oracle of the Zande royal clans was absolutely infallible. The king could come to a decision on the basis of his Benge oracle, which would decide yes or no whether a person was or was not a witch, and against that royal decision in the court there was no appeal. Now, this account, of which I've given you a very brief summary, hardly does justice to the complexity either of Zande culture or to Evans Pritchard's interpretive interest in it. But I'm not trying to tell you everything about the Zande in the 1920s. I simply want to give you some sort of sense of the process of suspicion, of accusation, of divination, of trial, of accusation and counter-accusation, indeed, which very often goes on in these sorts of contexts. The Zande are classic, but unfortunately for us, they're also atypical. There are two features, at least, of the Zande of the 1920s which need to be highlighted. One of these is that, remarkably, they had royal families whose methods of finding witches were infallible. They were able to tell you, yes or no, is this person a witch? This is something which would have been very useful to the kings of northwestern Europe in the early modern period during the great witch hunts, which I've already mentioned very briefly, the witch hunts of Shakespeare's time, the witch hunts in the reign of King James VI or first in the British Isles. Unhappily for these rulers, and unhappily for the clergy of Europe in the centuries before that and indeed since, Europeans have never known an infallible method for discovering witches. And this has led not only to a huge amount of hysteria, but also to very large numbers of deaths, some of them, quite possibly, of people who'd never practiced witchcraft in their lives, though probably many of them had. The whole subject of an infallible method of finding witches is clearly a very interesting one to human beings, and very rarely, apparently, in recorded history, have any peoples found methods which do seem to be infallible. In this sense, therefore, when reading Evans Pritchard's account of the Zande, one has to treat it on the one hand as very interesting and on the other hand as totally unilluminating, because it doesn't actually tell you how people cope with witchcraft under much more dodgy conditions, like the dodgy conditions of England and Scotland in their early modern times. However, there is another feature of the Zande which should be emphasised, and that is that I've mentioned already that some peoples have had, and indeed still have, more than one kind of witchcraft. As far as we can tell, our Anglo-Saxon and Jutish ancestors recognised only one kind of witchcraft. They called it witchcraft. But the Zande of the 1920s recognised at least two main kinds of witchcraft. I'll call them witchcraft A and witchcraft B. And I've told you about one kind, which is witchcraft A. The Zande have words for these two kinds of witchcraft. Witchcraft A is a kind which it is possible for people to inherit genetically from their parents without knowing it, and it is therefore possible to be a witch in Zande country without, as I've already indicated, knowing that you are one. It is therefore possible to do harm to other people, quite unconsciously, as we would put it, and if you confess that you have done it and don't do it again, you will be absolved from all guilt. Of course, if you persist in doing it after your witch character has been revealed to you, then clearly you are a criminal character and deserve the most severe punishment. However, the Zande also recognised another kind of witchcraft, let's call it witchcraft B, which was of a very different kind. You could not possibly do this without knowing you were doing it, because to do it involved the use of incantations and spells, of medication of various kinds. You had to have certain substances. In other words, it's the kind of witchcraft that English schoolchildren think of when they imagine witches huddled over cauldrons in which there are bat's blood and a whole host of other sinister ingredients. This is the kind of witchcraft that we associate with Halloween and with the female witches of modern Europe. Very sinister, very frightening, and the Zande were very familiar with it, though not with the trappings of European witchcraft. No question of worshipping the devil, no question of flying on broomsticks, no question of wearing Welsh women's hats. I'm not quite sure why Welsh women's hats have got associated with witches, but they certainly have. There's no doubt that they have. And I'll say a bit more about that next time. But this kind of witchcraft among the Zande, I'm calling it witchcraft B, this kind of witchcraft is a witchcraft of a quite different kind from witchcraft A. You don't inherit it genetically from members of your own family. And furthermore, even the king's poison oracle is not able to detect it. Potentially, of course, one can see that among the Zande of the 1920s, this was a far more dangerous kind of witchcraft than the type A. But interestingly enough, Evans Pritchard found, it was much less practiced, apparently, or at least the Zande themselves suspected it to be less practiced than the type A. There is a further complication, which I ought to mention before we go any further, about witchcraft, which springs from the very study of the Zande by Evans Pritchard himself. Evans Pritchard was confronted, as of course most anthropologists are confronted when they try to translate from one culture to another by the fact that he was writing in English, and English, as I've already emphasised, is rooted in the dialects of the Angles, the Saxons and the Jutes of lowland Britain, who had only one word for witchcraft and apparently only recognised one type of it. Evans Pritchard found himself living in the 1920s with a people on the Nile-Congo watershed of tropical Africa. They recognised at least two different kinds of witchcraft, and therefore, of course, Evans Pritchard faced a linguistic and translational dilemma. What am I going to do about using these words? Could I, for instance, use the Zande words? Of course he could, but this might become confusing for an English reader. Shall I call them, as I indeed just have, witchcraft A and witchcraft B? Evans Pritchard opted for the practice of calling one kind, what I've called A, witchcraft, and the other kind, which I have called B, he called sorcery. Now, this is an unfortunate development in anthropology, which has caused a great deal of confusion since Evans Pritchard's time. Sorcery in early English was a word of foreign provenance. It actually comes into English. You're probably all aware of this from French. And if you go back to the 12th century, sorcery was the French word that meant witchcraft, basically. And therefore, of course, there was no basic difference between them. If you ask people in modern English, what is sorcery, what is witchcraft, you'll find that a great many of them do not treat these two words as synonyms. You'll sometimes get the answer, well, witches are female and sorcerers are male, or something of this kind. But the point is, over the centuries, in the course of the last 1,000 years, the English language has drifted. Witchcraft itself has changed meaning, and so has sorcery. And therefore, of course, when Evans Pritchard calls witchcraft A witchcraft and witchcraft B sorcery, he is adding an enormous complication into the anthropological literature because he is insecure in the cultural foundation of what he is saying in the first place. Now, ever since Evans Pritchard published the book on the Zande, which he did in 1937, what has happened is that some earnest Africanists have set off on their field work trying to find, quote, quote, witchcraft and sorcery in, quote, quote, their people. This has not always been successful for the simple reason that many African peoples do not recognise more than one kind of witchcraft. The Rangi don't, the Mboe don't. There are whole hosts of African people who don't. Other African peoples actually recognise more than two kinds of witchcraft. So, in fact, you've got to be very careful when you carry out fieldwork not to assume that all peoples are the Zande. The Zande appear to have been among the most sophisticated of all African peoples in their response to the fear of witchcraft. A note of warning, then, that the classical literature may be misguiding rather than actually helpful. Evans Pritchard has confused the issue, he has muddied the water. But at this point, I need to take off from the Zande and look at the wider shores of witchcraft, as witchcraft and the fear of witchcraft as total human phenomena. I've already, perhaps by now, even by using quite briefly this classical Zande example, given you some sense of what is happening in a village or in some other small group of people, perhaps the ward of a small market town, when witchcraft accusations occur. Witchcraft is something which operates apparently only over quite short distances. Witchcraft is not something which is feared in the way that, say, a nuclear warhead on an interballistic intercontinental ballistic missile is feared. Witchcraft is, on the whole, something which is essentially short range. The shamans of the Amazonian basin, who can move thunderstorms about, are not practicing ordinary common or garden witchcraft. They're practicing something much more magnificent than that. It's worth emphasizing that the power which is available to people in witchcraft is not necessarily different in character from that which can be used in other contexts. Interestingly enough, among the Zande, you find that the kings are basically using exactly the same power as the witches. The witches use that power to find their to find out their neighbours and hurt them. The kings use the same power to discover who the witches are and to combat their evil machinations. This is by no means unique in Africa. Very often you find that the power of kingship is exactly the same as the power of witchcraft. Witches and kings are using the same power. If one is a good king, one uses one's power to combat the witches. One does not use it to harm one's subjects. Of course, if one is a perverted and evil king, one will use one's power, which is great, in precisely the way in which witches use it, and of course with worse effect, because being royal, you are able to do more harm than any of your commoner subjects. I suppose a crude analogy in modern Britain would be high explosive. High explosive can be used for a variety of ends. Some of those ends are seen as benign, some of those ends are seen as patriotic, some of those ends are seen as wicked. A particular kind of high explosive, for example, can be used by the IRA to set an explosive device on Charing Cross Station at rush hour. Precisely the same kind of high explosive can be used in bombs by the IRA's ostensible enemies, the RAF, to bomb targets which are of strategic significance to the British government. The British government's reaction to the RAF and the IRA is totally different. The IRA, we are told, are terrorists. The RAF, we are told, are patriots. To bomb targets, such as, for example, German cities in the 1940s, which are the enemies of the British government, the pilots who do this and their bomb crews are commended. They may even be decorated during or after the war. There is no likelihood that the IRA will be decorated for their efforts in causing damage and terror in central London. But as I've said already, the explosives that are being used are not necessarily any different at all. And this is the same as the way in which witchcraft power is used. The power of the king who finds the witches may be no different in basic character from the power of the witches themselves. The power of a shaman who uses it to harm the members of his own village may be identical with the power which he uses to land a thunderstorm over an enemy village. Basically, one is on the same wavelength of power. It's all much the same. Now, I said at the very beginning that there is a good reason for talking about witchcraft as the initial example when we are dealing with the whole processes by which human beings encounter the other side, the world of the mysterious, the world of the other. And the reason, I said, was that there is a relative simplicity about witchcraft. Relative, nothing human is simple. One can't expect the discussion of human beings to bed down to the levels of simplicity which are taken for granted by theoretical physicists. Human life is not simple in the way that physics is simple. Human life is very, very complicated. Human beings do not live in any sense whatever in ways that are simple. But witchcraft is relatively simple for these reasons. Witchcraft is based upon three fundamental assumptions in human life, and those fundamental assumptions occur in other combinations and in other contexts. The first of those assumptions is the existence of evil. Human beings are convinced of the existence of evil. That conviction drives their relations with other people. It drives their relations with their neighbours in their own community. It drives their relations with their collective enemies. The reason why one can justify bombing German cities in the 1940s, indeed, the reason why one can justify dropping nuclear warheads on Japanese cities in the same period, is because these people are in some sense evil. They can be justified as, in absolute terms, the enemy. This belief in evil is fundamental to human practices. Large numbers of philosophers over the centuries have questioned whether evil is real. They have questioned whether there is such a thing as evil or whether people can possibly be evil. But the point is, most people are not philosophers. Ordinary human beings are convinced that evil lurks in human beings, possibly in all human beings. That's the first assumption. The second assumption that lies behind witchcraft is different in character but related. It is that fundamental belief, which human beings apparently everywhere have, that they are surrounded by forces which they can neither comprehend nor control. Forces which are superhuman and which are able to guide human destiny. Human beings believe all over the world in the power of God. They believe in the power of the gods. They believe in the ancestral dead. They believe in the spirits of the wild places. They believe in the unwanted returning dead, ghosts. The English call them les revenants of modern French. They believe in these beings and they are afraid of them. And we'll have a lot more to say about this as the course goes on. But the assumption that there is this mysterious power around us, that we are in the presence of many witnesses, this is something which is fundamental to human beings. And in all recorded human societies, you find that there is a majority view that there is this kind of metaphysical context in which we all live. And there is another assumption which is closely related to it, and that is that if we get it right, we can get this mysterious power into our own hands. We can get it to work for us by prayer, by sacrifice, by incantation, by the right use of certain kinds of formulae, certain kinds of medication. We can bring this power to our own ends. Witchcraft, of course, is a fine example of that kind of thing. And there is a third feature which witchcraft has, and which is absolutely essential, of course, if people are to be afraid of it, and that is a deep-seated human conviction that other people are getting at me. People all over the world look over their shoulder to see what their neighbours are up to. Deep-seated suspicion is a feature of human behaviour. There's a great deal of it around. If you put these three fundamental assumptions together, what you get is a heady cocktail. The belief that evil is real, that it lurks in people. The belief that people get at other people. The belief that you are under pressure from other people's activity. And also, of course, the all-embracing sense of cosmic power, which under certain circumstances, certain people, but not necessarily all, can have at their command. Members of a priesthood may have it, diviners may have it, and, so we fear, witches may have it. If we take these three fundamental assumptions, and they are truly fundamental, believe me, you can test this for yourselves. Don't accept anything that I say just because I say it. Do check it. Check it in yourself. Check it in the people around you. Check it in what's going on in the books that you read. But these fundamental assumptions, put them together, and what do you get? You get witchcraft. Witchcraft is put together by the combining into a single cocktail of all these ingredients, and as I pointed out much earlier on today, it is clear that all over the world people have put them together to make precisely that cocktail. Now, it's worth making a few more general observations about witchcraft before I go any further, because witchcraft is capable of further analysis. But to an interesting degree, that further analysis has not been done. Hitherto, it's probably safe to say that anthropologists have not been too successful in their treatment of witchcraft, partly because they've not paid much attention to those numerous societies in which witchcraft accusations are rare or non-existent. There's been a tendency for anthropologists to concentrate their studies of witchcraft on societies where there are lots of accusations. Whatever the failings of anthropologists hitherto in dealing with witchcraft, it is important to point out that when we look at witchcraft, the great danger is that this is a subject of such emotive power that people are not going to be sensible in dealing with it. There is a danger that people will respond to the whole subject of witchcraft through a red mist, through a kind of crazy, hazy blur, that they won't focus on it, they won't treat it sensibly as a subject to be discussed like any other subject, but they will become hysterical, they will become emotional about it. And because of this, they will fail to see that there are at least three quite separate questions which we must ask and attempt to answer if we are dealing with witchcraft. The first of those questions is this. Does witchcraft, as a body of knowledge, have important consequences for human societies? I don't need to linger very long on this issue, because I hope that, even from what I've been saying this afternoon, there is some strong reason to believe that in some societies, at least, the human conviction of the power of witchcraft has immense consequences. Anyone who has read their way, not just through Evans Pritchard's account of the Zandi, but through the records of the courts in England and Scotland in the reign of King James, I hope will have a very, very vivid personal sense of the power of witchcraft as a force in human conviction. Even if there are no such people as witches, and even if there is no such force in the real world as witchcraft, we have little doubt, I hope, that large numbers of people died very young and very violently because of people's fear that witches are real. I agree that in some human societies the fear of witchcraft is minimal, virtually non-existent. But this doesn't alter the fact that in others witchcraft is a force to be reckoned with. In this case, the fear, of course, is the trigger. It is the fact that people fear witchcraft that matters, rather than the fact that witchcraft exists. But this brings us to the second question, and we must answer this question separately. The second question is this. Are there people, real people, out there who are practicing witches? This is a much more difficult question to answer than the first one. The first one is the question to which those historians and anthropologists who are interested in witchcraft have addressed themselves. They've addressed themselves in the first instance, of course, to witchcraft as a social phenomenon, to the whole question of the fear of witchcraft, the accusations, the court cases, the whole public demonstration of people's implicit belief that witchcraft is dangerous. And, of course, one can sympathise with the historians and the anthropologists who deal with this topic, because it is precisely these manifestations, these public manifestations of human fear, which are the phenomena most accessible to understanding and to investigation. When we turn to the question of, OK, who are these people? Indeed, are there any such people at all, or are they a figment of somebody's imagination? Clearly we move from the public and the fairly transparent to a much more murky world, a world of criminals. To investigate witchcraft is as dangerous and as difficult as investigating, say, the movement of drugs across the Mexico-United States border. This is a practice which may well be going on, but to find out who is doing it and to investigate further the precise processes involved is going to expose the investigator to possibly a rather speedy end. And the same is also true, of course, in investigating witchcraft. People who investigate witches might simply disappear. People who investigate witches might be found mysteriously dead in the river a few days later. The whole question of investigating witchcraft is not straightforward, and understandably we have many fewer books on the practice of witchcraft by those witches on their own account than we have accounts of which trials or which hunts or which fears or which accusations. However, the question does need to be answered. There is very good circumstantial evidence that some people are practicing witches. But even if we admit that that is so, we still haven't answered the third question, and this third question must now be asked, and it must also be tackled, though I must emphasise that it is the most difficult of the three to deal with. That third question is this. By now, some of you will have guessed it. Does witchcraft work? It's a very simple question. It can be asked in three words, but it is an extremely difficult question to answer. As I shall point out to you at some length next week, what is happening is that we are ourselves, of course, the children of a particular culture and a particular moment in the history of a culture. To discuss this subject, we must take into account the fact that we are the children of the Enlightenment, that we have lived in a particular phase of European history, a phase in which it has become unfashionable among chattering class people to believe that witchcraft has any importance whatever. Importance it must have, because something which can lead to the mass execution of large numbers of people is presumably of some importance. To say that witchcraft is of no importance is rather like saying that anti-Jewish feeling has played no part in the history of Europe. That is ridiculous, and we all know that. And therefore, of course, witchcraft must be taken seriously, but of course we come back to the point, does it actually work? Even if one answers the first two questions positively, one says, yes, we know that witchcraft is very dangerous as a belief because it leads people to kill other people. Yes, we admit that there are people who at the present time and in the past are witches or have been witches. But this still doesn't, of course, answer this critical question. What about, does it work? Well, does it work? The quick answer, let me give you a quick personal answer. I don't know whether it works or not. What I do know is that the kind of short-sightedness that we associate with the Enlightenment, which says it can't possibly work, don't be silly, is itself a silly answer. My own suspicion as an individual, based upon my experience of other people, is that there are certain human beings who do seem to have the power, by their own malice, to cause other people harm. I therefore have an inclination to believe that there is such a thing as witchcraft, that it's a real power, and that certain people, though not all, are quite capable of being witches. But that's a personal opinion. What I would say is that before we go any further with the study of witchcraft, we've got to get away from the kind of Enlightenment prejudices which make us not study this subject. We need to know a lot more about the kinds of things that witches do and the kinds of things that they are claimed to be able to bring about. What I want to do in the next lecture in this series is to turn our attention away from the global images of witchcraft and the global world of witches to a much more narrow field of operation, namely the British Isles, and to look at the way in which witchcraft has changed its meaning, but also the way in which witchcraft has reached terrifying intensities of activity in terms of people's responses during the modern period. I'll turn to that when we get to the next lecture.